Welcome to the Christadelphian Classics podcast, brought to you by Wilderness Voice. Principles and Proverbs by Islip Collier. Part 1, Principles. Chapter 2, Balance. Readers need not object to balance being chosen as the first principle for extended consideration. Balance expresses, in a single word, the scriptural idea of moderation and sobriety, of avoiding self-righteousness or of being righteous overmuch. It involves a recognition of the difference between camels and gnats and the danger of failing to recognize defects in our own eyes. The principle applies all round, and a fair consideration of it may deal salutary blows with impartial severity to writer and readers. The truest and most important of principles reveal themselves as distinct from all lesser rules of human conduct in that they shoot through from one plane of thought to another and prove equally true in all. This is unmistakably the case with balance. Whichever plane of thought we consider, material, mental, moral, or spiritual, lack of balance involves lack of stability. The townsman who attempts to assist in the hayfield discovers that the principle of balance is of first-class importance in piling up a load of hay. If he tries his hand as a loader, his first attempt will probably excite the derision of the countryman on account of its lack of balance. As the wagon rolls homewards, every shake of the conveyance will render the situation worse. The ill-balanced load will preach sermons with every awkward rut, if observers only have understanding eyes. Possibly, the complete collapse of the whole load, with damage and to life and property, will provide the final peroration. The principle applies to everything on all planes of action and with all degrees of importance. We want a well-balanced load or building or business or book or lecture or man or woman. It is obvious that the most interesting and important application of the principle is the personal. A community is made up of individuals. Businesses are run and books are written by men and women, including the business of the truth and books expounding divine principles. If improvements are to be effected, therefore we must begin with the individuals. A reader may say, "Begin with yourself," and this is excellent advice. We all need a little introspective care in this matter. If a man is not conscious of ever having been at all unbalanced, it's probable that he's never been anything else. It is like the matter of sound and successful work. "If you've known yourself to fail," said Ruskin, "then you have some reason for trusting your consciousness of success." Everyone knows that a little good work can be expected when everything is proclaimed as great. A Sunday paper used to print posters announcing that a notorious individual had written them for an article, "The greatest that had ever been printed." Readers could be almost sure that one still greater would follow next week. The claims were so extravagant that last no one took any notice of them. In the same way, a man who is never conscious of being at all unbalanced will not impress us as a sound judge. On the other hand, we may sometimes be positively startled to find the one who has revealed himself as altogether exceptional in the soberness of his judgments will make confession that he has at times been most deplorably unbalanced. We ought not really be surprised at this combination. It's the acute sense of balance that informs the individual of his error, and properly used brings about the poise, the fairness, the judicial and comprehensive view of the good judge. If we are able to say of two men that the only difference between them is that one knows he's under the influence of prejudice and the other does not know, we really affirm that there is all the difference between them. Even on the physical plane, it's the power to detect a deviation from the normal that enables us to keep our balance. A child learns to walk through taking note of those warnings and the punishment which follows if they're unheeded. If a man drugs himself with strong drink, the sense of balance is deadened and he falls. If a man is in vigorous health and with no drugs in his blood, he may deviate from the vertical with every step he takes and yet never be really unbalanced, because he knows exactly what he is doing. The sense of balance, which some authorities regard as a separate sense, as a real as sight or hearing, responds to slight deviations and supplies the corrective. Under abnormal conditions, the sense may fail us. Airmen have said that when flying at night over water, they've sometimes turned upside down without knowing it. A pilot has deemed that he was flying swiftly onwards with an even keel and then has discovered just in time that he was falling toward the sea at the speed of an express train. There is a startling resemblance between the physical and the mental in this matter of balance. Men may lack the acute sense that others possess, or they may lose their natural capacity through various influences. They may be drugged by false doctrine or by feeling. Either love or hatred may effectively spoil the sense of balance. We cannot go far, however, with such a list of opposite qualities. Pride will upset the balance, but humility will not. Anger will, but good temper will not. Envyings, variance, emulations, wrath, strife, most of the evil tendencies of the flesh will sadly disturb the balance of the best of minds. Joy, peace, long-suffering, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance, the fruit of the Spirit will tend toward a proper balance of the mind. Even love, when properly directed by the overruling love of God, will influence in the same direction. It's only the weak human love that may cause prejudice and lack of balance. Perhaps some readers may feel that in a Christian community the works of the flesh will be so little in evidence that we all ought to be able to maintain well-balanced minds. This should be so, but unfortunately never has been. The apostles showed that the works of the flesh were rampant in the early ecclesias, and we've no reason for supposing that human nature is any better now. Under the influence of the truth, men may conquer the grosser passions of humanity. They may reach the plane in which the excesses of human nature is at its worst cease even to attract. But at the same time, the more subtle and dangerous of fleshly taints may be positively accentuated. Strife about words to no profit has been connected with religion more than anything else. Such strife is placed by the apostle as one of the works of the flesh and is greatly disturbing to the mental balance. Pride, one of the worst of all fleshly evils, has often assumed its very worst form in the churches. It has so many disguises elaborated in the deceitful human heart that men may easily be self-deceived, claiming to be humble, to be jealous only for truth, and they may be only partly conscious or even quite unconscious of the consuming arrogance that has unbalanced them. That this has been so in the history of Christendom cannot be disputed. The scribes and Pharisees would have denied that they were proud, or at least claimed that theirs was the only a proper pride in the law of God. In reality, it was a fleshly pride that led them to the frightful sin of rejecting the Messiah. So it has been with Pope and priest and dissenting ministers, right down to the feeble-minded man who issues a leaflet with his portrait on the front page and an egotistical account of his conversion. Are we immune from this evil? Is there no danger that we may allow pride, well disguised, to take possession of us even in the work of the truth? Tom Hood declared that the proudest of all prides swells in a self-elected saint. Certainly in the claim of saintship there is most room for disguise. There is danger that we may swell with pride in the consciousness of saintship and the possession of superior knowledge. There is danger that arranging brethren in an ecclesia may magnify themselves as well as their office. There's danger that agitators may take pride in successful agitation, even though it's destructive. It's possible for individual critics to join in strife with the proud conviction that they alone can end it, or with proud contempt to stand aside from the strife that they despise. It is possible for brethren to judge each other thus proudly, and for whole ecclesias to thank God that they're not as others. Of all the evils of flesh, pride will most upset balance. And when men are unbalanced, pride is most effectually disguised. These, then, are some of the main causes for lack of balance in individuals or communities. How can we guard against them? How shall we detect a lack of balance in ourselves? That is obviously the first step toward restoration. There is one way, if we have the honesty to use it. It's to test ourselves by principles rather than by incidents. We can then apply the principles to matters in which we are relatively free from pride and prejudice, or whatever evil quality has caused the lack of balance. This method will readily be recognized as the true one if we take an extreme illustration. Suppose that a brother has given too much attention, say, to the book of Daniel. He often refers to the book and speaks of it whenever he can. So far, he may do well. To specialize is often helpful, and one who has exceptional knowledge of a particular subject can help others. This brother, however, drags in the book of Daniel when quite different subjects demand attention, and we begin to feel that he's lacking in balance in the matter. When he demands that candidates for baptism must have a knowledge of this particular prophecy far greater than that of the average brother, we are sure that he's becoming harmfully unbalanced. How can we correct him? Probably the first effort to restrain will give him the impression that we seek to belittle the book of Daniel. He'll rise passionately to the defense and quote the words of Christ, "Whoso readeth, let him understand," as if we were trying to oppose them. In this way, he'll become more unbalanced than ever. If, however, he can only be persuaded to consider principles and for a little while to escape from the microscopic examination of his favourite subject, he may be restored to a proper frame of mind. Some knowledge of the Word of God is necessary before one can be baptized, but not a profound knowledge. The new members are only babes in Christ, and they can still learn. Moreover, the knowledge required of the Word as a whole, not one part more than another. You do not require that they know all about the Temple of Ezekiel's prophecy, or that they must give a mature understanding of the law given through Moses. They must know and believe the first principles, and they must be ready to continue in learning from the Word. If led to think of these matters, the extremist may begin to realise that any attempt to find a principle on which to base his teaching would inevitably lead to confusion. Unless he's hopelessly unbalanced, he'll come to recognise that he cannot demand such thorough knowledge of all of the Bible, and therefore he cannot in reason demand it of the one part that most interests him. This appeal to principle and the choice of an example free from immediate prejudice is the best way to restore balance. It is as difficult for most men to take an impartial view of a subject in which they are greatly impressed as it is for parents to be unprejudiced in the affairs of a favourite son. If parents unreasonably complain that their son has been shamefully treated, our best answer is to persuade them, if we can, to contemplate an exactly similar case with someone else's son. If brethren unreasonably accentuate one feature of truth, our best course is to induce them, if we can, to look at another phase of equal importance. If we're called upon to move in any matter that is agitating the brotherhood, there must be an underlying principle of action, and that principle will cover many other incidents. Is the principle sound? Are we prepared to apply it not only to the one feverish topic of the day, but to everything else where it is properly applicable? If we're not so prepared, if we're inclined to resent the introduction of other matters and are even reluctant to consider principles at all in the matter, there's a serious lack of balance somewhere. If we're wise, we shall try to find a principle and examine it thoroughly, for by so doing we shall be finding the true balance of sobriety, temperance, and sound mind. There is another phase of this subject, too important to be considered at the end of a chapter. It has to do with the weightier matters of the law, which are so often neglected, and the lesser matters which are made to weigh too much. It has to do with the ever difficult task of inducing people who read the Bible to take notice of its plainest teaching, and the almost impossible task of convincing people that the eternal laws of God are of more weight than the traditions of men.